Vicatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vicatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking on a really fascinating figure, the Buddha. But maybe not the Buddha you think you know.
Right. We're looking at him through the eyes of Michael Carithers, an anthropologist.
Exactly. So less myth, more history. We're pulling Siddhartha Gautama out of, let's say, the purely spiritual realm and putting him right into 6th century BCE India.
Yeah, that's the core mission here, framed by Carithers. He wants us to see the Buddha not just as, you know, a holy figure, but as a historical person, a really sharp, pragmatic social innovator.
A genius, even, responding to his specific time and place.
He wasn't just off meditating somewhere disconnected. He was actively tackling the chaos of his world.
And this is why Carithers' work feels so relevant, I think. He argues pretty strongly that you can't really grasp Buddhism if you just see it as an abstract religion. Mm. You have to see it as this, like, cohesive system, a practical, almost psychological therapy designed for liberation. And it's grounded in observing how the mind actually works.
It really forces you to look at the whole thing through a very practical, functional lens.
So let's talk about the person giving us this lens. Who is Michael Carithers?
Okay, so Michael Carithers is a well-respected social anthropologist. He's professor emeritus at Durham University.
And what makes his perspective different? Why anthropology?
Well, that's the key, isn't it? His background. He's trained to study people and how they live, how societies work, not just dusty texts.
So he's looking at how these Buddhist ideas were actually lived, how they shaped communities, and how the communities shaped the ideas back.
Precisely. He uses that anthropological toolkit to focus on the lived reality. And he's really good at bridging the gap between, you know, hardcore Buddhist scholarship, he definitely knows the early sources, and telling a clear historical story.
He sounds like he's trying to peel back the layers of legend.
Yeah, he's very careful about that. Separating the plausible historical core from all the myths that grew up over centuries, he wants us to see the Buddha as a real person, a social actor, in a specific, messy historical context.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. What's the central argument Carithers is making?
Well, at its heart, the book is really an act of historical reconstruction. He's trying to recover the human dimension of the Buddha.
He's trying to answer, like, who was this person, really? And why did his ideas catch on so powerfully?
Exactly. And a big part of the answer is timing and context. Carithers does a great job painting this picture of 6th century BCE India. It was a time of massive upheaval.
The second urbanization, right?
That's the term, yeah. Basically, old tribal societies were breaking down. People were flooding into new cities. Kingdoms were emerging. Trade was exploding. It was chaotic.
I can imagine that would create a lot of anxiety, like the old ways aren't working anymore.
Huge existential anxiety. The traditional religious answers, especially the Brahmanical system with all its rituals and rigid hierarchies, just weren't cutting it for many people facing these new urban problems.
So the ground was fertile for something new.
Absolutely. And Carithers argues the Buddha's genius was twofold. First, his deep insight into the nature of this suffering. And second, his ability to offer incredibly practical, functional solutions.
Like the Sangha, the community.
Yeah, it's a prime example. Organizing the monastic community, the Sangha, based on merit, not birth, and his message of radical equality, these things resonated deeply because they offered a real working alternative to the rigid social structures of the time.
It sounds like this is really for someone who wants the historical Buddha, warts and all, maybe, not just the idealized version.
I'd say so. It's for the curious reader who appreciates scholarly rigor, but wants it presented as a compelling human story. It really demystifies him without diminishing his impact.
Okay, let's dive into the journey itself. Carithers places the Buddha firmly within a specific movement, right? The Shramanas.
Yes, the Shramanas. These were like the counterculture of the time. Wandering ascetics, philosophers, seekers who deliberately rejected the authority and the rituals of the mainstream Brahmanical tradition.
So he wasn't alone in seeking alternatives.
Not at all. He was part of this broader ferment. But Carithers portrays him as a kind of empirical investigator within that movement. He systematically tested the different paths available.
Including the extreme stuff, like starving himself.
Oh, definitely. He tried extreme asceticism, pushed self-mortification to the limit, and famously realized it was a dead end. It almost killed him.
And that rejection was crucial.
Hugely crucial. Carithers highlights this realization that punishing the body doesn't lead to liberation as the key insight that led to the middle way. you know, avoiding those extremes of self-indulgence on one hand and self-torment on the other.
Finding that balance. Okay, so that leads him away from extremes and towards enlightenment. How does Carruthers frame that? Is it purely mystical?
He frames it less as a supernatural miracle and more as a profound cognitive and psychological breakthrough. Something achieved through really intense, focused, rational inquiry combined with deep meditation.
A breakthrough in understanding.
Yes. And the core of that understanding was the insight into dependent origination. The Pali term is paikkasamuppada.
Okay, that sounds important. Break that down a bit. Dependent origination.
Basically, it's the understanding that nothing exists in isolation. Everything arises in dependence on other specific causes and conditions. Suffering, too. It's not random. It's not punishment. It's part of a chain reaction.
So, like, if I'm feeling anxious, that anxiety didn't just appear. It depends on certain thoughts, which depend on certain perceptions, which depend on certain experiences like that.
Exactly like that. It's a causal chain. Craving depends on feeling. Feeling depends on contact and so on. All rooted ultimately in a fundamental ignorance about the way things really are.
And the breakthrough is seeing that chain.
Seeing the chain, understanding how it works, and crucially realizing that because it depends on conditions, if you change the conditions, you can break the chain. You can end the suffering.
Wow. Okay. That's a powerful idea. It makes suffering understandable, maybe even solvable.
Precisely. And that leads directly to his most famous teaching framework, the Four Noble Truths. Carruthers really insists we see this like a doctor's diagnosis and prescription.
Okay, so the Four Noble Truths as medicine, what's the diagnosis?
First noble truth. The illness is dukkha. Carruthers stresses this isn't just physical pain. It's a deeper, pervasive sense of unsatisfactoriness, stress, or dis-ease that comes from the fact that everything is impermanent.
Things change, we want them to stay the same, and that causes stress. Dukkha makes sense.
Second noble truth. The cause of the illness is tansha. This is usually translated as craving or thirst. It's that relentless wanting, grasping, clinging, wanting pleasant things to last forever, wanting unpleasant things to disappear immediately.
Okay, illness identified, cause identified. What about the cure?
Third noble truth, there is a cure. Cessation is possible, nirvana. And fourth noble truth, the cure, the prescription, is the path, the magga, which we know as the Noble Eightfold Path.
And Carruthers emphasizes something specific about this path.
Yes, it's integrated nature. It's not like a menu you pick and choose from. It has three interconnected parts: ethical conduct, sila, mental discipline or concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, prajna. They all support each other.
So you can't just like meditate your way to wisdom without working on your ethical behavior.
According to this framework, no. The ethics provide the stable ground for the mind. The mental discipline sharpens the focus, and that focused mind can then develop genuine wisdom or insight. It's a complete system.
That integrated system then leads to maybe his most radical idea.
Arguably, yes. The doctrine of no self, or anatta, is really counterintuitive for many of us.
The idea that there's no permanent, unchanging soul or self at our core.
Exactly. He taught that what we call I, or me, is actually just a temporary collection of changing physical and mental components processes, really. There's no fixed independent entity running the show.
That's a lot to take in. It sounds potentially liberating, less ego to defend, but also maybe a bit scary.
It can be. But Carruthers connects it directly to the goal of ending suffering. If you deeply understand there's no permanent self to protect or aggrandize, that clinging, that tancha, starts to dissolve. Ego clinging is seen as the root of so much conflict and anxiety.
And he didn't just teach this abstractly, right? He built something around it.
Right. This insight wasn't just for hermits. It was translated immediately into a social structure. And this is where Carruthers really emphasizes the Buddha's genius as an innovator.
The Sangha, the community of monks and nuns.
Yes. Carruthers argues the creation of the Sangha was just as significant an innovation as the doctrines themselves. Think about it. It was a voluntary community.
Voluntary. Okay.
Based entirely on shared values, ethical conduct,
yeah,
and commitment to the path merit, not on birth or family ties or social status.
Which was completely radical for India at that time, with its rigid caste system.
Absolutely revolutionary. It provided a living, breathing, alternative model for how society could be organized.
Yeah.
Your worth wasn't determined by who your parents were, but by your actions and your understanding.
Now, was it truly that egalitarian in practice, though, even early on?
Carruthers acknowledges, you know, human institutions are never perfect.
Yeah.
There were internal politics, debates, challenges. But the founding principle, the ideal it strived for, was meritocracy.
And that principle itself was powerful.
Immensely powerful. The very idea that spiritual liberation was accessible to anyone who put in the effort, regardless of their background, that democratic impulse gave the movement incredible energy and allowed it to adapt and spread across so many different cultures for centuries.
Okay, let's try to boil this down. If someone listening wants the key takeaways from Carruthers' perspective, what are maybe three core themes?
Okay, theme one has to be the pragmatism and the therapeutic focus.
Right. He wasn't interested in abstract debates.
Not at all. The focus was laser sharp. What works to end suffering, right here, right now. He famously set aside purely metaphysical questions like, is the universe eternal? Calling them unhelpful distractions.
That feels very relevant today, doesn't it? With all the noise and information overload. It's a call to focus on what's actually useful, what problems we can actually solve, instead of getting lost in endless speculation.
Definitely. Okay, theme two, the democratization of spiritual authority.
We just touched on this with the Sangha, breaking down barriers.
Exactly. Making spiritual attainment possible for anyone, low caste, high caste, man, woman, though there were complexities there initially, it was a direct challenge to the inherited power of the Brahmin priests.
It really underscores the potential within everyone, valuing capability over background. That's a timeless lesson applicable way beyond religion.
For sure. And at theme three, the interconnectedness of ethics, mind, and wisdom.
The integrated path we talked about, Shila, Samadhi, Prajna.
Yes. You need the whole package. Ethical conduct isn't just about being good in a moralistic sense. It creates the calm, stable mind necessary for deep concentration.
And that concentration, that samadhi, is the platform you need to develop real insight, real prajna.
Right. So ethics becomes a kind of essential mental hygiene. Mm. It's practical preparation for clarity. You can't expect profound insights if your mind is constantly agitated by unethical actions or intentions.
It makes ethics feel very functional, not just like a set of rules. Okay, Carruthers also highlights some core ideas that come across almost like quotes, right? Capturing key concepts.
Yeah, he synthesizes things powerfully. Let's look at a few.
How about this one? I teach one thing and one thing only. Suffering and the cessation of suffering.
That just cuts right through everything else, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It brings it back to that core, pragmatic, therapeutic purpose. No fluff.
Totally. And this one really speaks to the social innovation aspect. The genius of Buddhist monasticism lay not in its withdrawal from the world, but in its creation of alternative models of social organization based on merit rather than birth.
Yeah, that highlights the institutional brilliance. It wasn't just about personal enlightenment. It was about building a sustainable alternative community structure that could embody those values. That's why it lasted.
And maybe one more, focusing on the individual. Be a lamp unto yourselves. Take yourself to no external refuge.
That's so powerful. It puts the responsibility squarely on the individual. Your liberation is up to you. It's about empowerment, self-reliance, not looking for external saviors.
Okay, so if this is all so practical and therapeutic, how might someone apply these ideas today? Let's make it concrete.
Well, take the Four Noble Truths, that diagnostic framework. You can apply it to almost any problem. Let's say chronic stress about work performance.
Okay, walk me through it. Job stress.
Identify the dukkha.
Right. So acknowledging the suffering. I feel constantly anxious about meeting expectations, worried about falling short, and it's exhausting. That's the dukkha.
Step two. Diagnose the tantra, the craving.
What's driving it? Maybe it's craving external validation, needing praise, wanting that promotion. Or maybe it's aversion-intense fear of criticism or failure, identifying that specific thirst.
Step three, envision cessation. What would relief look like?
Imagining a state where you can still work hard and be effective, but without being gripped by that constant need for approval or fear of failure. Feeling okay regardless of the outcome.
And step four, implement the path, the magga.
This is where the Eightfold Path comes in. Maybe it's right effort, consciously redirecting your focus from worrying about future outcomes to the quality of the present task, or right mindfulness, noticing those anxious thoughts and cravings arise without automatically buying into them or acting on them.
That process sounds like it would build serious emotional intelligence and resilience over time.
Exactly. Using mindfulness, understanding impermanence, and realizing thoughts and feelings come and go helps create that crucial space, that pause between stimulus and reaction.
So instead of automatically lashing out when criticized or spiraling into anxiety when you make a mistake.
You notice the feeling, you notice the impulse, but you have a moment to choose a wiser response. That's resilience. That's freedom from habitual reactivity, which the Buddha saw as a primary cause of suffering.
And you mentioned leadership lessons from the Sangha.
Yeah, Carruthers points to its incredible longevity. Its success offers lessons in organizational sustainability. Focus on core adaptable principles like meritocracy, shared ethics, rather than getting bogged down in rigid, brittle rules. That flexibility allowed it to survive and thrive across vastly different cultures and times.
That's a great point for anyone running an organization today. Adaptability based on core values.
Definitely.
Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive, what's your final personal takeaway from looking at the Buddha through Carruthers' lens? What really stood out to you?
For me, it's the sheer coherence of his vision that Carruthers illuminates so well. It's not just a collection of interesting ideas. The doctrine, like no self.
Yeah.
The practice, like meditation. The ethical framework. And the social structure, the Sangha. They all lock together perfectly.
Like one integrated system.
Exactly. One single functional design aimed at human flourishing and the end of suffering. It's incredibly elegant when you see how the pieces fit.
My takeaway is similar, actually. It's seeing how inseparable the spiritual insights were from the practical social engagement. Carruthers really drives home that the Buddha wasn't just a mystic. He was a brilliant social innovator tackling the real-world problems of his day.
Yeah, his spiritual genius and his social genius were two sides of the same coin.
And that makes his insights feel less like ancient history and more like, well, a relevant toolkit for navigating our own complex times.
Absolutely.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accadra Foundation.